It was the night before Christmas Eve, and I was pretty much asleep, just vaguely listening to the traffic noise drifting from the A23, when suddenly my heart jumped and my eyes flew open. The time floated in front of me, glowing from the clock radio. 2:35 a.m. At that moment, everything seemed quiet, and I wasn't sure if the scratchy noise that had woken me had really happened. I instinctively reached my arm out to Pete's side of the bed. It was empty. Then I remembered he wouldn't get back from the French trip until morning. Being married to a long-distance lorry driver has always suited me. I like to have time to myself, and listening to Pete's aging rocker collection can get a bit wearing when it's on every night. When he's away, I sit in my study pretending to work and occasionally yelling, "Leave it," out onto the landing, just in case one of my two teenage children or the dog is doing something they shouldn't. This near Christmas, they all get a bit overexcited, including Pete. He's not what you'd call mature. Living in an old house with a rather loud family, I've got used to unidentified noises in the night, so I wriggled under the quilt to go back to sleep. But then I heard the distinctive scraping noise again, coming from downstairs, and there was something about that noise that I didn't like. The old horror films always have a brave, but in my opinion, stupid woman, who gets up in the night to wander along dark castle corridors with no more to protect them than a white nightie and a candelabra. But then the scraping noise started up again, and I found myself pulling on my dressing gown and reaching for the hairdryer. So with the flex in one hand and the dryer impersonating a cosh in the other, I made my way along the top landing. The scraping noise had moved to the hallway. As I got to the top of the stairs, it had stopped, and I braced myself for what I might find. Even so, I didn't expect to find the front door wide open to the street and a chill wind blowing through the hallway. I leant over the banister to see into the living room below. At first, nothing significant seemed out of place, but my brain was telling me that something was wrong. There was a gap between the sofa and the television, a gap that lately had been filled with our Christmas tree. That tree is as much part of the family as our dog George. George has been with us for 11 years through thick and thin, and so has the tree. All right, it's past its best in going a bit bald, but to be honest, so's Pete. But from the moment I pull that silver flue brush out of the attic until I hoover up the last shreds of its tinsel leaves, it feels like Christmas. I know every wonky branch of it just as well as I know each mole on my kids' bodies. And every Christmas Eve, when the kids go out with their friends and Pete goes down the pub, it's just me and the tree, and I've come to depend on our time together. It was one August bank holiday when I'd given Pete a bit of a tongue-lashing that he didn't really deserve. I went up into the attic to get some peace. I needed somebody objective to talk to, so I dug the tree out from behind the boxes of old toys. But pouring your heart out to an undecorated artificial Christmas tree feels a bit like trying to pet a dead dog. So I wrote what it was about on a post-it note and put it in Aunt Jessie's hat box on top of the wardrobe. And by Christmas, I had 15 of these little notes. And that Christmas Eve, and every one since, as soon as the rest of them had gone out, I got out my pile of post-it notes and stuck them on the branches like flat yellow bubbles. And then I worked my way through them one at a time, and I tell the tree everything that's annoyed me during the year. By the time I screw up the last note, I'm ready to give the people close to me a Christmas full of unconditional love. So you'll understand that the tree being gone was a bigger crisis than the door being wide open in the middle of the night. I bent double and peered through the landing banisters. As I looked across the hallway from my spot at the top of the stairs, I could see ghostly strands of abandoned angel hair trailing across the whole carpet and clinging to the last rail of the balustrade as though the tree had tried to save itself as it was being dragged out of the door. I was just following that thought to its natural conclusion, that somebody must have undertaken the tree napping, when I heard the unmistakable clunk and whir of my car cold starting early on a winter morning. It's a battered old thing, but I do love it, so I ran down the stairs just in time to see my little Cleo pulling away from the curb, and through the side window I caught a flash of silver. You might think that I acted recklessly, and you'd be right. I snatched up Pete's bike keys and reached for my good red coat, and I was out the door. The Cleo was already at the end of the close. I jumped onto Pete's Kawasaki and I was off. Actually, I was right off. I'd forgotten how heavy the bike was, and the force of my weight leaping onto it had toppled me off over the other side. That was when I remembered that I can't ride a pedal cycle, far less a 1000cc symptom of the male menopause. I was a bit at a loss, but then I heard my neighbour call from his bedroom window. "What the fuck are you doing down there?" he said, and an idea came to me. You see, Danny's got an ancient Honda 250, and he's had his eye on Pete's Kawasaki for the last 2 years. I was beckoning Danny downstairs with an anxious, come hopeful expression on my face when I saw the look of horror cross his, and I remembered that I was wearing my pink dressing gown with the Maribee feathers, which probably didn't go too well with my pre-Christmas curlers. I threw my red coat over the pink satin, and then, nodding at the fallen bike as an indication of what was needed, I tucked the Maribee feathers under the collar of my coat with one hand and stuffed curlers in my pockets with the other. Once Danny got the message that it was the bike that wanted sorting out and not me, he came downstairs with alacrity. It doesn't do to upset my Pete. He's got Hellraiser written through him like Blackpool through a stick of rock. Danny's a big chap, and he got the bike upright with one sweep of his arm, which was quite impressive, but my mind was on other things. "Follow that car," I shouted breathlessly and unoriginally, pointing to the end of the close, where there was now, of course, no car in sight. He shrugged at me with that expression I've come to recognise as, "Oh dear, a woman at that funny age." But I was already on the pillion and grabbing at his leg to get him over the bike in front of me. "My Cleo's been taken," I began, and I was about to add, "and I think our Christmas tree was driving," when I realised that might not encourage him to join me. Luckily, that had seemed to be enough to appeal to his spirit of adventure, and he leapt on, and we set off so fast I lost two curlers from my left pocket. I'd like to say at this point we were wearing crash helmets. I'd like to say that because I like to make a good impression, but I'm afraid I can't, because we weren't. We had a slight hiccup when we got to the end of the close. I hadn't told Danny to turn left. However, I found that a slap on the left side of his head as he headed to the right served its purpose, and we veered round and sped off up the hill to the A23. I didn't know whether the tree would be heading north or south, but I gathered it would be heading for the open countryside. A silver tinsel tree driving a Renault Clio might stand out a bit in London. So I gave Danny another dunt and we took the south carriageway. It was quite exhilarating, belting towards Brighton with my arms round a nice burly man, and I'd quite forgotten why I was there when Danny raised one arm and pointed to the side of the road. At least that's what I thought he was doing. He was actually trying to loosen my vice-like grip on his chest, so I eased back gruntedly and we carried on. It was about that point that I became aware of the police siren. The fact is that having the wind in your ears and hurtling along on a nice big motorbike in the middle of the night at about 90 miles an hour builds up a good wind, you can't always tell which direction a siren is coming from. I guess it's not surprising we attracted attention. Apart from the speed and no crash helmets and me in a big red coat over a pink satin dressing gown with Maribou trim, Danny was still in his Marks and Spencer's pyjamas. We caught up with the Clio just south of Crawley, which was about the same point that the police caught up with us. The Clio turned off at Three Bridges, and so did we. The police car missed the turning. There was a nasty screech of brakes, and as we slowed for the roundabout, I saw the Panda car emerging the wrong way from the other slip road. I gave Danny another slap to get him to stop, but since we hadn't arranged any hand signals before we started, he took this as an indication he should keep going. I meant to raise a hand in apology to the officers, but as we belted off in a renewed burst of speed, I needed both hands to hang on. I made an attempt to wave at them, but Danny's driving was a bit erratic, and as I was intermittently grabbing towards his pyjama top, I think it looked more like a wanker gesture. And that was probably what annoyed them. They came round the roundabout the wrong way to cut us off, but Danny got onto the pavement in front of them. That was when they caught me on their in-car video. I do remember I was a bit cross with them because they'd just missed my leg and another curler fell out of my pocket and bounced across their bonnet. In fact, that's what I was swearing about. I just realised I'd have to buy more curlers. Anyway, by now we were on the Balcombe Road and pretty close behind the Clio, but the police were pretty close behind us, and that was when the Clio braked. It was all right for us because the bike didn't need much space. Danny made a fancy swerve to the left and we tilted over far enough to the road that I almost didn't have to shave that leg for a while, but the police car was heading straight for the back of the Clio. It seemed more polite to watch rather than just bugger off, so we stopped. The police get some nifty driving courses, but I doubt if they were taught that manoeuvre at Hendon. In the space of about 50 yards, the police car went to the left and then the back of it spun to the right, and then it rotated 180 degrees so that it was going backwards, and just as it looked like it was about to smack arse to arse to my poor Clio, she was off, knocked to 60 in 5 seconds. I was very proud. But then I remembered to look to see who was driving, and what I saw amazed me. George the dog was in the passenger seat with his seatbelt on. I'd been wondering where George was. He's supposed to be a guard dog, but he's never quite understood the concept. Cats, mice, burglars, there's room for everybody in George's world. But I'm sure I'd never seen him wear a seatbelt. So there I was, sitting on my husband's motorcycle, driven by my underdressed neighbour, watching my dog and my Christmas tree drive off in my car, while two very grumpy police officers tried to do a three-point turn in a country lane behind me. What would you do? We hit the road again. The Clio had a bit of a head start, but we weren't that far behind. If I leant right out, I could see past Danny's elbow and spot the taillights disappearing round the next bend. The police seemed to be having a little trouble with their engine. They were still behind us, but the car didn't sound at all well. I felt quite sorry for them. In fact, I was thinking about getting Danny to stop just to help them out when we came round the last bend and found the car. I hesitate to say it was parked. I think dumped would be a more appropriate description. Three wheels were still more or less on the road, but the fourth was caught up in a hedge, and the car was bouncing gently with the engine still running. The driver's door was wide open, scraping the ground. There was no sign of the dog or the tree, but I saw angel hair drifting from the steering wheel. Danny made straight for the car, but I was after the tree, and the best chance of finding it was to find the dog. I called out, and hearing an answering yelp from the woods, I headed along a narrow cinder path. I really should have put some shoes on. I also remembered it was after 3 a.m, and now I was in the woods, in the dark, with either a tree napper or a tree that could drive for company, and I didn't know which was worse. I could hear George snuffling amongst the dried leaves. It's one of his favourite pastimes, snuffling. I was glad one of us was happy. I now had a missing tree in a trashed car, and I still had getting arrested to look forward to. I found George at the top of a small cliff. At the bottom, I found the tree. When the police officer found me, I was sitting on the edge crying, with George's head in my lap, where he was chewing one of my curlers and ruining my satin dressing gown. I was glad it was a policewoman. Men don't understand times like these. She sat down beside me and dangled her feet over the edge. I thought she was very trusting. I wouldn't have come near me without a tranquilizer gun and a net. She patted George's head. Would you like to tell me what the hell is going on? I handed her the note I'd found tucked in George's collar. Since you brought me home from B&Q, I've had 11 years of being dressed up nice and welcomed into your front room. Each year I've watched you all open your presents and got none. And then you start to look at me as though you want me to disappear. The boxes come out, all my fancy decorations come off, and I get dragged back up the attic steps and thrown in the corner. I feel used. It's time to let me go. The policewoman leant forward and looked over the edge at the tree. A piece of tinsel had come adrift in the fall and was lying a little way away. The last of the angel hair was gently swaying, creating a white halo around it, as though it wasn't really there. She shook her head, looking at my tear-stained face. It's only a Christmas tree. She brushed her hands down her skirt and stood up. The way I see it, your car's trashed and that'll be your loss. We'll send you a letter asking who was driving. If you can't or won't tell us, then we'll charge you as the owner with reckless driving and you'll get points and a fine. I opened my mouth to speak, but then I thought better of it. We both knew I wasn't driving, but neither of us wanted to go over the alternatives. As far as the bike's concerned, we'll assume your neighbour was driving with permission. He says he doesn't know anything other than he was helping you to chase your own car. I gave a nod, and she raised her eyebrows, but continued, checking off a mental list. He'll get done for speeding. Again, that'll be a fine and points on his licence, and you'll both be fined for not wearing helmets. We won't do you for the chase. She looked back towards the road. I think my colleague quite enjoyed it. We both raised our eyes to heaven in the traditional female bonding ritual. And that just leaves the tree. Surely you're not going to charge the tree with anything? She looked at me as if I'd just lost my last marble. Fly-tipping, madam, is an offence. By the time we'd given all the details and got George and the tree back in the car, it was about 5 a.m. I couldn't get George to wear the seatbelt, which annoyed me. It took us a lot longer to get home because the front near side wheel had a bit of a wobble, and I wasn't about to start speeding again with a cop car following behind. Danny started snoring in the passenger seat. I couldn't blame him. One of my legs had gone to sleep and the rest of me was jealous. As we turned into the close, Danny suddenly jerked awake. Shit, the bike, he yelled, turning to look at me. I'd forgotten all about the bike. Pete was going to kill me. But then I saw where Danny was pointing, and there was the bike, back in its usual place outside our house, and I got an inkling of what was afoot. As I suspected, I found Pete sitting in the lounge waiting for me. He was sprawled out on the sofa with his headphones on, but I could tell he was pretending to be relaxed. George ran in and threw himself at him, licking him as though he hadn't seen him for years. I could hardly miss the 6-foot Norwegian fur blocking out the window and the 3 John Lewis bags leaning against the arm of the sofa. I looked in the bags. They were nice decorations, red and gold. I sat down on the easy chair and waited while Pete began to look embarrassed at George's overacting. He took off the headphones and turned towards me, leaning his elbows on his knees. It was that tree's time to go. I wasn't impressed. It might be your time to go. Pete was only thrown for a minute. I noted I needed some new threats. He leaned over to the tree and spread the branches. You can get a lot more stuff on this tree than you could on the old one, and a lot more presents underneath it. I thought of my neat little pile of post-it notes waiting in Aunt Jessie's hat box. There was certainly a lot more space on this tree than the old flue brush, but, well, call me fickle, it did look like a good listener. I got to my feet, but I wasn't giving in just yet. However big that tree is, you won't get a Renault Clio under it, and you'd better have bought me a new one by Christmas morning, or you really are dead. He grinned and got up to follow me, but I stopped him and pointed him towards the back door. You'll need the spade from the garage, I said, if you're going to give that old tree a proper burial. I couldn't sleep until I'd added another post-it note to the pile, apologising to the old tree for letting it go. It was still on my mind when Pete came up whistling to himself in that self-satisfied way of his when he thinks he's won. I rolled over under the quilt and started to plan the tree's revenge.